Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is on sabbatical. Coming up, teachers in Newark, New Jersey join in daily demonstrations for justice. The Black is Back Coalition gears up for its national conference in Philadelphia. And Howard University students and alumni join the occupation. But first, much of the world was shocked and horrified at the gruesome killing of Muammar Gaddafi by a mob of NATO-backed gunmen in Libya. The Nation of Islam has enjoyed warm ties with Gaddafi's government for 40 years. Minister Louis Farrakhan went on Cliff Kelly's Chicago radio show to talk about the slain Libyan leader.
I have lost a very, very important member of my own family. So I can't take the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi lightly, as I could not take the assassination of my brother or my mother or my wife or my children lightly. That's the kind of relationship that we had and that we have. So I come to say to the world that the Nation of Islam mourns the loss of a great brother leader, the lion of the desert, the lion of Africa, and those who rejoice at his death. Your laughter will turn to tears, and your joy will turn to sorrow and great pain, because of what the Western world and those collaborators will lose as a result of his betrayal and his ultimate assassination. He spent billions of dollars trying to get African leaders to remember something that I heard from the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson. He said, "It's better to be the tail of something than the head of nothing." So he was trying to get African leaders out of the mindset of having a seat on the United Nations, having your flag represented and a national anthem, and economically you're still a slave. But if all 53 or 54 now of these countries united, with a central bank, which they were working on, a federal government, and a language that all of them would accept as the official language of Africa. Oh, my goodness. Railroads and highways tying all of these nations together, trading within themselves and beyond themselves. Africa would then be a power in the 21st century. And this is what Marcus Garvey saw. This is what Padmore saw. This is what Osagyefo Kwame Nkrumah and Gamal Abdel Nasser saw. And this is what Brother Gaddafi was working on at the time of his assassination. He had already set up an African Development Bank. How much money was in that bank, Brother Akbar? I heard it was about $70 billion, so that Africa would not have to go to the World Bank, would not have to go to the International Monetary Fund. They could go to their own African Development Bank and borrow money without this exorbitant interest and build Africa. This is what Brother Gaddafi was doing, and I hasten to tell you, my dear Mrs. Clinton, ooh, you are in for a shock. If the vultures of Europe think they're going to pick that body. Now, of course, you're trying to get back in there to make sure that whoever comes to power will be in your favor. Well, like you thought when Mubarak went down. But look at what's happening in Egypt now. This is going to happen all over the world. I want you to know that you're through as a world power. Through. Through.
Minister Louis Farrakhan on WVON Radio in Chicago. Occupation forces in Oakland, California, were forced out of their encampment in a violent police assault and then reclaimed the campsite with the blessing of an apologetic mayor. The protesters have voted to shut down the city in a general strike on November 2nd. The occupation movement seems to have spread everywhere, including Columbia, South Carolina, where writer and activist Kevin Alexander Gray is based. Gray says the movement has made a deep impression on the national consciousness, but every day the protesters must confront the same burning questions.
What's next? What's next if the police come in and violently remove you? What's next as far as attacking structural inequities? What's next in how do you disempower the corporations? What's next as to how you disentangle political leaders and your elected officials from the corporatocracy? How do you organize grassroots efforts and make them sustainable and have them have a structural impact on elite capitalism and exploitation? How do you involve the communities that are most affected by this exploitation? Although all communities are affected, obviously black folk or people who are traditionally oppressed or suppressed or repressed have it worse. And if the whip comes down, they're going to get lashed harder. So one of the central questions that I've asked the people with Occupy Columbia and with Occupy Wall Street is this about, and we're talking about predominantly white groups, is this about your lost expectation of white privilege, or is this about fighting and abolishing privilege altogether? You have to answer that question, and how you answer that question determines how you move forward.
And what kind of answers did you get?
Well, everybody says it's a very good question. I haven't really gotten a whole lot of answers, but everybody knows that that's the central question. So how do you involve black folk? You expect people who are under the whip to just come down and join your protest? Well, have you ever gone out and helped them with their protest? Have you really reached out to the communities? What have you done? Bearing in mind that the black community is woefully disorganized at this point in time for a number of reasons, from the folk who were doing the organizing and doing the political education have just gotten older, to folk have been co-opted and bought off, to, you know, just not having a clear, coherent political strategy, to folk buying off into this idea that you're poor or you're destitute or you're oppressed or oppressed because it's your own doing. You ought to take some responsibility for yourself in this capitalist environment and go out and get your job with the man.
One could ask our own people a variation on that question. Are you just protesting to get what white people have or what you think they have, or do you want to really change society?
I mean, that is the central question, and it goes back to Dr. King's speech to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference right before he died in regards to the dichotomy between capitalism and socialism and the need to find a third way. And so for years, no one's really defined what that third way beyond capitalism and socialism is. I mean, the critique, if you're talking about why you would occupy Wall Street, well, Wall Street is about exploitative capitalism run amok. And globalism run amok. And capitalism and global forces, exploitative forces, maintaining control of the government. And that 1% that everyone's talking about having inherited wealth that they've passed down for generations and generations. So that's really the crux of the biscuit. You know, the whole idea that this country was set up to protect a rich white male property class, and well, that's the root of the problem in American society, and that is the root of capitalism. And just from a black perspective, we do argue that the linchpin of modern capitalism was chattel slavery. So, you know, unless the people at Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Columbia, Occupy wherever, don't fundamentally understand those basic things, then their movement, if that's what it is, is going to be flawed from the get. It means, as we posed the first question, they're just kind of angry because of their lost expectation of privilege and participation in that system. Their idea of the American dream is that one day they can go to college and they too can be a millionaire, or they too can, you know, be able to have the house that's on HGTV with all the granite and you know, overlooking the river. I mean, that's, we have to look at how we're living and how people are living. And this idea that everybody believes that they ought to have luxury or facsimile of luxury, and it ought to be at the expense of somebody else's resources, somebody else's labor, somebody else's oil, somebody else's whatever it is that this country thinks they need at any particular time.
And on the black side, we see that much of what we like to call the black misleadership class is totally in bed with Wall Street.
Well, they're just by getting paid. And when you go back and look at black organizations, be it the Rainbow Coalition, be it the NAACP, be it the National Action Network, be it the Urban League, when you go back and look at their list of funders, you know, Wells Fargo Bank, which is being sued now for its subprime activity, or Chase, or Citigroup, or Bank of America, or Coca-Cola, all these organizations get money from the very people that we ought to be challenging as it relates to their practices. And we ought to be telling people not to do business with them. So they get that little hush mouth money and they hush in their mouths. Or, you know, we got the situation now where who is the person closest to the president? It's Sharpton. And, you know, Sharpton's history as it relates to the black struggle is as an informant from most people's perspective. So now we've got an alleged FBI informant that's supposed to be the leader of the black community. And they, of course, they lead us to listen to the Barack Obama tell us how, or tell the nation under the monument to Martin Luther King, how he was really a champion of capitalism and American exceptionalism. And so, you know, the people are confused, or the people want to be confused. But yes, Reverend Jackson always said you can't ride the freedom on Pharaoh's chariot, but a lot of them are driving Pharaoh's chariot for him. I would love to see, in the same way that Tom Joyner, Steve Harvey, Michael Basedon, Warren Valentine, Al Sharpton, did I leave anybody out? I would like to see them go after Minister Farrakhan and call him a pimp and call him a whore and call him a hater in the same way that they did Cornel West and Tavis Smiley. Let me see if they're so bold as to do that.
So any black confrontation with Wall Street would inherently mean a confrontation with much of what passes for black leadership and with this black president.
Absolutely. It would shut off their money sources. They are not going to speak up because they can't. I mean, listen, and it's going to probably get me in some trouble personally, but, you know, for Reverend Jackson to go to Wall Street with those kids in solidarity with them, but to not to even say, well, I'm not going to do my Wall Street project anymore. Well, that's kind of hypocritical. And nobody questioned him on it. Nobody challenged him on it. But now that's due to the fact that a lot of those kids out there are so ignorant to black history and black politics and arrogant to it, other than philosophically maybe understanding white supremacy or academically, intellectually understanding white supremacy, but not really looking at the contours and the everyday goings on within black politics, because they haven't humanized us to that extent.
And we see that the vaunted black solidarity with Africa is really quite shallow, with the lack of response to the butchery of Gaddafi and the butchery of his country.
Absolutely. I mean, the most radical voice on what happened to Muammar Gaddafi, on Libya's role with the African Union, on Libya's role in funding and supporting developing African nations, on the deaths of so many sub-Saharan Africans during NATO's bombing campaign, and the fact that NATO, on the record, killed more people than they're accusing, or they accused Gaddafi of supposedly killing with very little evidence, and the fact that Gaddafi has had a relationship even in this country, if you want to talk about the relationship he's had with the Nation of Islam and who supported the building of the mosque in this country, everybody's kept their head down while President Barack Obama has expanded an assassination program with drones, be it with supporting NATO and their culpability and cooperation in the killing of Muammar Gaddafi, to the assassination of an American citizen overseas, to the assassination of all these nameless Afghanis and Pakistanis with the drone attacks. Nobody's talking about the fact that contrary to a Republican president, Gerald Ford, who signed an executive order forbidding this country to be involved in assassinations abroad, people have seemed to be cheering this kind of carnage and barbarism on because they've gotten that invitation to the White House, or they think that they're protecting a black president who has done very little to advance the economic well-being of black people in this country or around the world. He's leading the way to the neo-colonialism that's going on in Africa even as we speak.
We see corporate media saying that Barack Obama is doing quite well in foreign policy, and yet every instance they cite involves an assassination.
Well, this country from the beginning of its Constitution, Declaration of Independence, has been at war every 20 years. And for the most part, it's been at war against darker-skinned people. So, of course, the national media is going to cheer Barack Obama killing people of color because that's what this country does best.
Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina. The occupation of Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. has passed the three-week mark. Organizer Kevin Zeese says the protesters have been very busy making life difficult for the bankers, the Pentagon, and their servants in Congress.
We've done some great actions to close down banks. We've closed down two city banks. That's the bank that received the highest TARP funds and hasn't paid taxes in 4 years. Its CEO makes $9 million plus, and they pay their tellers $12.55 an hour. So we shut them down twice. We shut down a Wells Fargo and a Bank of America. We've also been focused on the Chamber of Commerce, which is the corporate bully of Washington, D.C., with repeated actions. We've done three actions so far, one on jobs, one on housing foreclosure, and one on the military-industrial complex at the Chamber of Commerce. Chamber of Commerce, the corporate bully, is definitely feeling the wrath of the Occupy movement. In addition to dealing with the private sector, we've also dealt with the government. We have had actions in the Senate and the House. We shut down every Senate office with an action in the Hart building. I don't know if they had been told in advance by the police, but that's the process. Shut your office down when the protest has come. But they did that. It's the first time I ever remember it. In all the years of working in D.C. on these kinds of issues, that the senators actually locked their doors in fear of protest. So we were pretty proud of that. And then we also had an action when Leon Panetta and the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff testified at the House Armed Services Committee. And we had seven people arrested, one accused of assault, even though she didn't get within 10 feet of Panetta. We had another great action, actually had three parts to it, when the Joint Deficit Commission finally met in public. They've been doing all their work in private. We had action outside the building, outside the Hart building, in the hallway outside, loud chants. They could hear them inside. The chant was, tax the rich, end the wars, end the deficit. And then inside the building, Leah Bolger, inside the committee hearing, Leah Bolger, who is a vice president of Vets for Peace, stood up and went to the front of the committee hearing, in the well of the committee hearing, which is a very bold thing to do, and faced the senators close up and told them that they were lying about the military budget, that the military budget is growing exponentially, it's bloated, needs to be cut. She just was very bold, and we're very proud of her. She stood up there and told the truth and, of course, was arrested for it. Leah is a great advocate for ending wars from Oregon. So every day we have action after action. We've had great speakers. You were one of them, Glenn, on the first day. We also had Cornel West, who did a great job here. He is always an eloquent speaker, but he also took action with us. We did a march to the Supreme Court. And even though the Constitution says Congress shall make no law abridging our freedom of speech or right to assembly, it's illegal to hold signs on the steps of the Supreme Court. And so we held signs on the steps of the Supreme Court, had a rally there, and 19 of us were arrested for that. So every day we're doing great things here. I hope people can come down to Freedom Plaza. Check us out on OccupyWashingtonDC.org. This is a very effective action, and we're just getting started. So it's been a great 3 weeks, and I hate tenting. I hate sleeping in tents, even though I was in Yellowstone Park, but I'm doing it in Freedom Plaza because I think this is the only way that the voices of the people can be heard. One of the really great things about this Occupy movement has been how we've already affected the debate. You look at the polls before we started and after we started, we've gone from this silly focus on deficit to now focus on jobs and getting the economy moving again. Dramatic shifts in the polling. We're having an impact, and I think that's because we're occupying public space, and by doing that, we're also occupying political space that they have to deal with.
You in D.C. got an extended permit, but we see occupations being shut down all over the country.
We're actually being threatened, D.C., because the permit doesn't really protect us that much. All the permit does is allow that no one else can apply for a permit while we're there. But it does not allow us to occupy. It does not allow camping. It does not allow sleeping, cooking in the park. It does not allow us to accept prepared foods from churches or restaurants that want to support us. So every day we're violating that permit, and we've been told by the park police that they're getting pressure from the administration to enforce the no camping, no cooking rules. And that in a week or 10 days, we may find ourselves in conflict with the police. So we're also in the process of building our community support. I had a meeting last night with the faith community. I had a meeting earlier in the week with a bunch of unions. It's incredible support we have. People are so enthusiastic about the American people finally finding a voice. So it's really a fantastic time for building this movement. And we're ready if the police come. We're ready to face arrest. We are going to stand strong on this and insist that our voices can be heard, that we continue to be allowed to occupy public space.
You said pressure is coming down from the administration. I thought the administration was trying to make noises as if it was in sympathy with the occupations.
Well, that's what's interesting about it. You know, and the words from the administration came from the police themselves. I don't know whether that means the White House or that means, you know, the Department of Interior, led by Secretary Luzon. Well, I can't imagine in this political year that we're in now, where Obama's in campaign mode, that they would take action against the Occupy movement without the Obama political team reviewing it first. So we are doing right now an effort to get the word out to the Obama administration that we are nonpartisan, but we can be sure that if he does not stop us from being evicted and arrested, that he will be blamed for it.
Kevin Zeiss with Occupy DC. Students and alumni at Washington's Howard University rallied in solidarity with the occupation movement. Talib Karim, who graduated from Howard's Law School in 1995, is one of the organizers. He says the occupation movement needs some color.
What we've said is that as you see across the country, starting from Wall Street, spreading throughout the East Coast and even the West Coast, those people who are leading the Occupy movement are largely young, white, disenchanted people who have definitely recognized the challenge and the outrage with the disparity in income, with 98% of the people or 99% of the people who are at the bottom 1% of the wealth holders. And so we as African Americans certainly recognize that in terms of jobs, which is the thing that has been lost in this stratification of wealth, with the jobs that have been lost, African Americans have been the hardest hit by that job loss. That's an outrage. So clearly, the African American community definitely understands what the Occupy movement is all about. But heretofore, we have not yet fully embraced it, and that's, I think, what we're planning to do or in the lead. As you may know, that Professor Cornel West and Raheem Devon were arrested just a couple weeks ago, and that was a beginning, I think, of the overwhelming solidarity that I believe is going to be demonstrated with our march and other marches that I expect will take place across the country.
And what's the reason for black reticence, at least initially, to join this movement? Is it because of the occupation folks' inability to reach out, or black folks' unwillingness to reach back?
I think there are two varying reasons from different perspectives. on one hand, I think that, you know, it's just human nature, for example, when you're organizing something to reach out and organize with those people who you know. And regardless of the fact that we have elected an African-American president, we are beyond being able to say that we are a colorblind society, fully integrated, working side by side with people of all colors. And even some neighborhoods that are integrated, they're still not integrated, if you understand what I mean. So the people who are organizing this march, you know, being young, white, sometimes affluent people, those people who they know and organize with the people they know, and that's what you see represented. But also I think that from the African-American perspective, one of the things that we realize is that, one, for those who are employed, you know, they don't have the luxury to be able to oftentimes leave work and you know, camp out or even protest for a few hours or so because of just the hectic pace of our life, having to deal with our responsibilities, including raising children, caring for our elder family members and the like. So that's on the one hand. But then on the other hand, I think it also has been an issue of a lack of focus. The Occupy movement has been great, underscoring the vast disparity in income and pointing out the corporate excesses. But there have been no clear goals, no end game, if you will. And I think that oftentimes African Americans definitely appreciate organization, at least on that level, and they want to see, well, what is the desired outcome and objective. And that's the reason we're marching for clear goals, and that is a goal of articulating the fact that we don't have jobs. And the fact is that the corporate America is sitting on over $400 billion in corporate profits. Dow Jones and the NASDAQ are at all-time highs. We have the record unemployment rate. So that means that the money is there to invest in the American workforce, but the corporate elites have chosen not to invest in America and in American work. Instead, they're outsourcing jobs to places like China and India. And regrettably, our president has just signed three trade bills, the free trade agreements with Colombia and with South Korea and with Panama. We'll see more jobs being outsourced outside the United States and companies being able to take advantages of favorable taxes and other benefits by doing so. So these are the types of dual-edged swords that we stand firmly against, and we stand in solidarity with our white brothers in the encampments across the country. And I believe that those are the things that will start to get, I think, more African-Americans and out to the marches, and more Asian-Americans for that matter as well, more Latino-Americans, until we can see a total movement of all the people who are in that 99% that should be standing solidarity, and including those people who, you know, signify with the Tea Party. They are in the same economic boat as we are, and yet, regrettably, they've been brainwashed into supporting policies that are really against their financial interests.
The Howard University contingent has some very clear goals. You call for an end to wars and a reinvestment in green energy and forgiveness of loans, college student loans for the unemployed or the underemployed.
Absolutely. As you know, there has been a report indicating that the American college graduate and student college is currently shouldering $1 trillion in student loan debt at a time where we have, as we just said, 53% of the American workforce, including a large number of those who have gone to college, who cannot find jobs in their chosen professions. So how are we to be able to repay the money that we have borrowed in order to get the training that we have gained? And this is the thing we're saying. The United States government can bail the likes of Goldman Sachs and other companies, including those companies that are reporting record profits and giving their corporate elite and their board members multi-billion-dollar compensation plans, then why not bail out the American worker and the college graduate who is, again, shouldering $1 trillion in student loan? We need to come up with a loan forgiveness program that eliminates the debt that is basically shackling a large percentage of Americans, particularly African Americans. This is in one way another form of economic slavery, which to break the shackles of economic slavery, if you will. And that's why that type of conversation is the same type of conversation that you hear in these encampments across the country. So again, I think that there is a definite unison of voices, and by us joining and linking up with the occupation movement this past week and joining with these brothers, we are showing that we are all on the same page economically.
Attorney Talib Karim can be contacted at 202-256-0499. He says Howard University alumni plan a long-term relationship with the occupation movement. Members of the National Nurses Union are providing medical services at occupation encampments across the nation. In Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel's police twice made mass arrests, pushing protesters out of their base. Jan Rodolfo was one of two nurses taken away by police.
We were some of the last arrested. We actually stood there in our medical garb with our equipment and watched the police tear the tent down around us, the first aid tent, and then were taken to the jail. And nobody expects to enjoy time spent in jail, but really believe that the conditions were even beyond what was acceptable. I mean, we were freezing cold, generally without any jackets. We weren't fed for hours and hours, and ultimately got a couple slices of bread and like a piece of bologna in 22 hours. We were denied our right to a legal phone call for the full time we were in jail. Never got that call. And they confiscated our mattresses, despite the fact that other prisoners who were coming in off the streets for non-protest offenses were given mattresses. So there was a very particular message sent that they were going to make us being in jail as difficult and as unpleasant as possible. And then ultimately we were released 22 hours later, which was almost 12 hours after the initial protesters began being released. And they pretty clearly waited until the media and the cameras went home before they were willing to release nurses. They really would like to send a message that they don't want nurses, they don't want labor to be involved in the Occupy Chicago movement. It's going to have the opposite effect. I think it's actually really strengthening our resolve to continue being involved.
Did you anticipate that you might get arrested for doing what nurses do?
I certainly hoped that that wouldn't happen. I think that even in military combat type situations, medics and healthcare professionals are usually respected as a special category. So I was, I'm not going to say surprised, but pretty outraged and saddened that Rahm Emanuel wasn't willing to respect that.
Do you think this should hurt him and his reputation?
I think that mayors across the country have come up with ways to make these encampments work in their cities. And I think that that shows a respect for the suffering and hardship that people are facing. It conveys a message of wanting to work with people who are suffering poor conditions rather than having a punitive approach. So, yeah, I think that it reflects badly on him.
Now, of course, you weren't just doing this as an individual, but as a member of National Nurses United.
We started a campaign in the spring to put focus on Wall Street as the problem and the cause of the financial crisis and ultimately where the solution lies, calling for a tax on Wall Street, a financial transaction tax. And we did an early Wall Street demonstration in the summer, and I like to think that we had some small role in catalyzing the idea of doing Occupy Wall Street. But really it comes down to, we've been relating to Occupy Wall Street since the beginning, and we've been doing medical care in a number of cities. But it really comes down to what we see at the bedside every day. I mean, when you work as a nurse in a hospital, you see patients who delay care. You see patients who come in with ulcers and high blood pressure and all kinds of stress-related illnesses. We see the suicide rate increasing. And we discharge patients with medication prescriptions like that for pain medication after surgery, knowing that they're not going to be able to actually afford to fill those prescriptions. And it breaks your heart over and over again. So when a movement crops up that captures the voice of that suffering and that desire to change, it really grabs you. It really inspires you. So I think nurses are very drawn to the Occupy movement.
So the nurses of your union are not just administering aid as nurses, but are part of the political force itself.
I think we're fellow travelers, and it's important that a young movement like the Occupy movement be given air and space to develop its own beliefs and tactics and politics, but I believe that they need the support of the labor movement. And so we thought long and hard about the most effective way to show that support concretely, and we decided that providing medical care in what can be some pretty tense situations is the best way to show that support.
Jan Rodolfo of National Nurses United in Chicago. The occupation movement engages a broader range of issues as people of color join the ranks. The Correctional Association of New York has endorsed the occupations. The Correctional Association deals with issues of incarceration and the prison industrial complex. Executive Director Sophia Elijah says any genuine social justice movement must make the prison system a priority.
The United States incarcerates 2.3 million people, 25% of the world's incarcerated population, even though the United States population in general only comprises 5% of all the people on the planet. So we far outdistance any country with our rate of incarceration. The good news in New York is that the numbers are going down. But the bad news in New York and throughout the country is that black and brown people are disproportionately represented behind bars to the tune of between 60 to 80% of any given prison on any given day. So that's having a huge impact on our communities and the health of our community.
So how should that fact, those stark facts, be reflected in any movement to change the social order?
Well, I think we have to change the public perception of what the use of incarceration should be for. It should absolutely be a last resort. Some would argue for abolition of prisons, and I actually agree with that model, but I know that that's a long ways off, should I say. In the meantime, I think we should push to downsize prisons and reduce the reliance on incarceration to deal with misconduct. The overwhelming majority of people who are in prison are incarcerated for behavior that could be addressed through social service intervention in large measure. But we don't seem to rely on those options because those options don't grab at the emotions and don't yield votes. And that's really what it all boils down to, a dollars and cents and political ping pong situation that most people who are incarcerated find themselves caught up in.
You emphasize that prison is a business. How does that relate to a general complaint that big business, and especially big banks, dominate our society?
For instance, prison construction was the fastest growing economy in the United States. Some 20 plus years ago, when I first started looking at this issue, you couldn't find anything in the Wall Street Journal about prisons, prison labor, prison industrial complex. Now, investing in prison and prison construction and all companies that service prisons is a major opportunity for investors, which clearly shows that it's a driving economic building block of the U.S. economy. There are countless industries that are driven by the existence of prisons, from the vending machines to all of the junk food that's in the vending machines to the towels that are used, the uniforms, the wax, the security systems. It just goes on and on and on. The money that's been spent to finance prisons and the running of prisons could be better spent on social service programs that would serve the people who find themselves incarcerated and who were in need of those services before they went in.
So people are demanding that business get out of being embedded in our politics. Are you saying that business ought to get out of prisons?
Absolutely. We should close down totally the concept of prisons being a business. In some states, you find a move towards privatization where companies are bidding to the state so that they can run prisons. And we can easily imagine where that's going to go when you do a cost-benefit analysis. Programs that are needed to help people successfully reenter society are going to be cut, and any private business is going to be looking to how they can make the most profit by investing the least amount of money.
What does it mean to the future of prison reform or prison abolition when we see that Wall Street itself is heavily invested in prisons?
Well, you know, just like we called for big business to divest out of South Africa, perhaps we need to take the same kind of approach with respect to businesses and being invested in prisons and prison construction and prison industry.
And would you like to see those kinds of demands reflected in the occupation movement?
Absolutely.
And how can we affect that?
Well, you know, in various cities in the occupied movement has general assemblies that meet, and I would hope that those general assemblies would consider the issue of prisons and the economic underpinnings of the prisons and call for a moratorium on prisons, prison building, and prison usage as an option for meeting the ills and concerns of society. It's much more important for us as a society to address social concerns by using social solutions as opposed to the cheap, quick fix of basically burying people behind bars.
Sophia Elijah in New York. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations emerged 2 years ago, partly to show that there were organizations on the black left that had not been seduced by the Obama presidency. The Black is Back Coalition holds its national conference November 5th in Philadelphia and had planned a march and a rally, but the Philly police initially refused to grant a parade permit. Just as suddenly, the police relented and issued a permit, according to Black is Back conference organizer Diop Olagbala.
So the initial excuse was that all the city's resources were tied up in Occupy Philly itself. You should understand that we had submitted our application for the permit on September 22nd, which was several days before there was ever even a discussion about it in Occupy Philly. And somehow, miraculously, the city found the resources to grant the permit or allow for Occupy Philly to happen while they did not find resources to get the permit for Black is Back's march.
Basically, what you were maintaining is that the city was using funds or a lack of funds to deny Black is Back its right to express itself politically.
That's exactly the message that we got. That's how it has to be interpreted. And to my knowledge, and I'm pretty sure this is common knowledge, that budgetary constraints have never been some type of condition to determine the right to free speech for anybody in this country.
So they were saying, we don't have the money, so you can't march.
Well, all of a sudden they found the money. I guess a militant demonstration and press conference gives them the ability to find the money, find solutions very quickly.
What is the relationship, if any, between the Black is Back conference and demonstration and Occupy Philadelphia?
Well, I think that there are certain questions that both the Black is Back Coalition and Occupy Philly stand on the same side of. Of course, we're both opposed to the parasitic ruling class of this country of U.S. imperialism, as they would characterize it, the 1%, the banksters, the CEOs of major corporations and Wall Street, etc. But of course, there are questions that the Black is Back Coalition has the ability to even further deepen and clarify in the ways that other sectors of the population do not, precisely because it is the oppression and exploitation, it's the war on the black community that makes it possible for the 1%, Wall Street, etc., to enjoy any wealth at all or have any wealth to provide jobs for the general white population.
What's Black is Back trying to accomplish on November 5th?
So on November 5th, the march is entitled Stop the Wars, Build the Resistance. And the purpose of the march is, of course, to expose the U.S. government's wars of aggression being waged against oppressed people throughout the world, the war against Muslim and Arab people, the wars against the Mexican people who are held captive in their own land, and, of course, the U.S. government's war on African people throughout the continent in the form of the occupation and invasion of Libya, Uganda, Ivory Coast, etc., and the U.S. government war on the black community right here in places like Philadelphia, Detroit, Los Angeles, etc. And we want to expose this war, and more importantly, we want to continue to build organized resistance to end this war and to result in freedom and self-determination for our people.
In addition to all your other activities, you're running for mayor.
Correct. Yes, I am running as the only independent anti-imperialist mayor on the ballot here in Philadelphia, Waleed Diop Rahman, running for mayor of Philadelphia.
Diop Alagbala with the Black is Back Coalition. There's been a kind of occupation going on in Newark, New Jersey for more than 130 days since the middle of June, when the People's Organization for Progress, or POP, launched daily demonstrations for jobs, equality, peace, and justice. POP says they'll keep up the daily pace for 381 days, the duration of the 1955 bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama. The local retail workers' union agreed to handle protest duties on certain days, and now the Newark Teachers Association has joined them at the demonstrations. We spoke with Teachers Association President Annette Alston.
The fight for justice is across the board, especially right now with corporations, the corporate mindset that seems to be sweeping the nation. It's as if the corporations have the answers for everything, when in fact, the corporations are the reason why we're in this economic situation that we're in right now, this recession, depression. It's all about greed. There's no excuse not to put the job act through. There's no excuse not to make it so that people can make a living wage. There's no reason for unions to be attacked, because unions basically protect living wages. They help people to not be exploited. And that's what this is all about. We felt that we are in sync with POP and what they're standing for, and we need to come out and speak out.
Are you actually going to have teachers on the line?
Yes, we are. There are teachers here, and they're more on their way. They're a little slow, but they're on their way. So, yes, there will be teachers here.
Do they have the stamina?
I believe that they do. Keep in mind, 381 days is the number of days that the Montgomery bus boycott lasted. They had the stamina, and I believe that we do today as well. Our cause is just. It's just as it was 50, 60 years ago when they were boycotting the Montgomery buses. We have to take a stand.
Some people might not make the connection between corporate greed and what's happening to the public schools.
There is an absolute connection. Right now, when we leave from this rally, we're going to go into another rally at Bethany Baptist Church, where we're fighting for local control of the school system. Newark Public Schools has been under state control for 16 years. And within those 16 years, the state really has done nothing to better the education system for local control. Christie has come in to push charter schools, largely for-profit charter schools, into the system. This is about greed. He's about vouchers, about privatization and supporting school vouchers. It's really not about the children. And you'll see when you look at the whole school voucher system, the way they want to do this, it's about supporting corporations or supporting private schools and private entities, but it's not about supporting our public schools or our children or bettering and improving the situation. Christie said that he could find over $1 billion to put into voucher schools, yet he froze funds when he came into office that would build schools, build more schools, and would fix schools that are in desperate need of repair.
And yet the narrative is that teachers are somehow at fault for what's wrong with the public schools.
Teachers are the ones who spend hundreds and thousands of dollars sometimes out of their pockets in their classrooms. They're the ones who come in early and stay late, come in 7:30 in the morning, stay till 5, 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night. We're working. We're working hard, and everyone knows it. Parents know this. But right now, again, it's about union busting. It's really not about the truth in any sort of way. It's about trying to weaken the unions. And New Jersey has one of the strongest unions in the country, and it also has one of the best school systems in the country. It's not a coincidence.
Annette Alston, president of the Newark Teachers Association. Paul Street has written two books on Barack Obama as candidate and as president. He's also been closely following and participating in the occupation phenomenon. Street says the Democratic Party would love to co-opt the movement, but the demonstrators aren't buying what Obama's selling.
There's this kind of lame equation that became quite popular in the corporate media early on, that this was the Tea Party of the left. You know, sometimes you hear the Democratic Party's version of the Tea Party. Well, what they're talking about is this so-called social movement, this fake populist, top-down pseudo-movement called the Tea Party phenomena that, as you know, I wrote this book about with Anthony DiMaggio, really was very much about and electioneering. And really, at the end of the day, under the guise of being some sort of grassroots citizens uprising, was really about electing hard-right Republicans to the Congress, and ultimately they would hope into the presidency. I don't sense much interest on the part of movement participants in Occupy Wall Street and its offshoots. They are conscious about the danger of being hijacked by electoral politicians, in their case, the Democratic Party. And they really don't seem to want any particular part of that. They really have an understanding of themselves as being a social, not an electoral movement. I've said many times at meetings around here, and other folks have said it as well, the famous Howard Zinn quote, that it's not about who's sitting in the White House. It's about who's sitting in, you know, in the workplaces, in the schools, in the offices, in the legislative halls, and that. About direct action. God knows that the Democrats, you know, they're desperate. You know, Obama's looking at possible defeat. Who knows? I'm not going to predict what's going to happen. But they've functioned very much as we said they would from the beginning, in accord with the dictates of their Wall Street corporate and imperial master, and alienated a whole bunch of people. And they see in this movement, clearly, you know, there's no secret about this. This is pretty well reported. You know, an opportunity to give themselves a kind of rebranding, a glossing over, a populist makeover. And they're hoping that this OWS can do some of what the Tea Party phenomenon did for the GOP in November 2010. And to that I say good luck, because I think this is a different kind of energy here. These kids, and they are mainly kids, it's a very, well, one of the big differences between the Tea Party and OWS is age demographic. This is kids in their 20s and early 30s. There are some older people like myself hanging out in it. But they've really gotten a lesson from all the hope and change rhetoric dissolving into nope and continuity reality under Obama. They really got it, that this system is bipartisan. The dark cloud of money that cripples and destroys democratic politics and policy in this country, a small d democratic, I should say, doesn't discriminate. That cloud is as powerful when Democrats are in the White House. Even a charismatic non-white Democrat is in the White House, you know, with a Muslim-sounding name. It doesn't make any difference. And they've really gotten a lesson about how the unelected dictatorship of money controls both wings of the American one-and-a-half-party system. And frankly, one of the reasons, with all my warnings about Obama early on, like you and other folks at Black Agenda Report, I was screaming from the beginning that Obama was not what progressives seemed to think he was. But one of the reasons I sort of ironically wanted him to win in November 28 is because I really felt that millennials, kids, people 18 to 30 years old, desperately needed it. The lesson, the object lesson of the corporate system, the imperial system, marching on and screwing up and ruining people's lives from the top down with Democrats in office instead of just George W. Bush and the Republicans, which is sort of all they knew. It was their entire cognizant political life coming out of junior high and high school, was that this ogre, these horrible Republicans from Texas and elsewhere were in charge. And to see that the shit just continued to hit the fan, the corporate bailouts, the horrible healthcare system that isn't really addressed, the joblessness, the massive inequality, unmatched inequality in the world, that all that marches on with the Democrat, and that they're getting it now, that electoral solutions are not going to be the answer.
As a veteran political analyst, could you have imagined 2 months ago that we would be now having this generalized conversation about how to get finance capital off of our books?
No, I was a little depressed, too depressed to imagine that, to be honest with you. I had a vague sense out there. I did have this hope that that object lesson would take place and that some sort of left social movement was going to arise, you know, in the wake of some of the lessons of the Tea Party and how they changed the political discourse. There was a certain amount of direct action. It was all choreographed from the top down. But it was a certain amount of direct action and protest activity between elections. And then, of course, there was that very interesting moment in Madison, Wisconsin, and some other Midwestern state capitals in February and March of this year. There was a genuine upsurge of social movement that ended up, at the end of the day, being demobilized in deference to union bosses and Democratic Party bosses in Wisconsin. But nonetheless, it was a real contest. Something going on. I know there's this undercurrent of economic populism, and I've seen public opinion data for years that shows that most Americans are pretty much economic populists and don't like concentrated wealth and extreme inequality and its impact. But I never could have anticipated how that suggestion from Adbusters magazine way back in July, you know, would be picked up on by a relative handful of leftists, Marxists and anarchists, and that they would show up in August and have an organizing rally outside the iconic Wall Street Bull statue and go with that day suggested by these, you know, these left kind of anti-consumer Canadians. That's what Adbusters is out of Canada. And develop this remarkably impressive organizing strategy and this democratic decision-making process is very informed by international models in Greece and Spain and Latin America and elsewhere. You know, in this cosmopolitan cauldron of New York that these folks would come together and find the support they did. It's a really remarkable story. I like to think I predict a lot of stuff, but I notice I have had a pretty good predictive record on kind of negative things that are happening, you know, like how bad Obama would be and how the vacuum that arose in the wake of Obama would be something that a right-wing pseudo-populist movement would exploit. I sort of predicted that in both of my Obama books. But when I know it don't seem very good at predicting, and maybe you just can't, and you don't have to predict, and you just have to seize the moment and enjoy it and work with it. So this notion of working off the Tahrir Square example and occupying the actual belly of the beast and really naming, as you said in Black Agenda Report, you know, the name and the address of the enemy, finance capital, Wall Street, that would be so successful and resonate across the country to more than 800 locations and even overseas. No, I never would have imagined that, and we'd actually be having a discussion about the ruling class. Now, I think who the ruling class is and how it rules is more complicated than the 1% versus the 99%, but it's a pretty good starting point, and we are the 99%. There's a pretty good chance.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.